I came out of rehab a few years back, this great detox center that the old man paid for, and I kicked ass for a long time. Then I crashed.
Why? What made you crash?
It's always the same. When you're an addict, you can lose it any time, any place, for any reason. They haven't designed a wagon that can hold me. I'm an addict, bro. Plain and simple.
Still drugs?
Sure. Last night it was booze and beer. Same tonight, same tomorrow. By the end of the week, I'll be doing nastier stuff.
Do you want to?
No, but I know what happens.
The waitress brought their food. Forrest quickly buttered a biscuit and took a large bite. When he could speak, he said,
"The old man's dead, Ray. Can you believe it?"
Ray was anxious to change the subject, too. If they dwelt on Forrest's shortcomings, they would be fighting soon enough.
"No, I thought I was ready for it, but I wasn't." "When was the last time you saw him?"
"November, when he had prostate surgery. You?" Forrest sprinkled Tabasco sauce in his scrambled eggs and pondered the question.
"When was his heart attack?"
There had been so many ailments and surgeries that they were difficult to remember. He had three.
"The one in Memphis?"
"That was the second one," Ray said. 4 years ago.
"That's about right. I spent some time with him at the hospital. Hell, it wasn't 6 blocks away. I figured it was the least I could do."
"What'd you talk about?"
"Civil War. He still thought we'd won."
They smiled at this and ate in silence for a few moments. The silence ended when Harry Rex found them. He helped himself to a biscuit while offering the latest details of the splendid ceremony he was planning for Judge Attlee.
"Everybody wants to come out to the house," he said with a mouthful.
"It's off limits," Ray said.
"That's what I'm telling them. Y'all want to receive guests tonight?"
"No,"
said Forrest.
"Should we?" asked Ray.
"It's the proper thing to do, either at the house or at the funeral home. But if you don't, it's no big deal. Ain't like folks will get pissed and refuse to speak to you."
"We're doing the courthouse wake and a funeral. Isn't that enough?" Ray asked.
"I think so. I'm not sitting around a funeral home all night hugging old ladies who've been talking about me for 20 years, Forrest said. "You can if you won't, but I will not be there."
"Let's pass on it," Ray said.
"Spoken like a true executor," Forrest said with a sneer.
"Executor?" said Harry Rex.
"Yes, there was a will on his desk dated Saturday. A simple one-page holographic will, leaving everything to the two of us, listing his assets, naming me as the executor. And he wants you to do the probate, Harry Rex."
Harry Rex had stopped chewing. He rubbed the bridge of his nose with a chubby finger and gazed across the diner.
"That's odd," he said, obviously puzzled by something.
"What?"
"I did a long will for him a month ago."
All had stopped eating. Ray and Forrest exchanged looks that conveyed nothing because neither had a clue what the other was thinking.
"I guess he changed his mind," Harry Rex said.
"What was in the other will?" Ray asked.
"I can't tell you. He was my client, so it's confidential." "I'm lost here, fellas," Forrest said. "Forgive me for not being a lawyer." "The only will that matters is the last one," said Harry Rex. "It revokes all prior wills, so whatever the judge put in the will I prepared is irrelevant." "Why can't you tell us what's in the old will?" Forrest asked. "Because I, as a lawyer, cannot discuss a client's will." "But the will you prepared is no good, right?"
"Right. But I still can't talk about it."
"That sucks," Forrest said,
and glared at Harry Rex. All three took a deep breath, then a large bite. Ray knew in an instant that he would have to see the other will, and see it soon. If it mentioned the loot hidden in the cabinet, then Harry Rex knew about it. And if he knew, then the money would quickly be removed from the trunk of the little TT convertible and repackaged in Blake and Son boxes and put back where it came from. It would then be included in the estate, which was a public record.
"Won't there be a copy of your will in his office?"
Forrest asked, in the general direction of Harry Rex.
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm reasonably sure," Harry Rex said.
"When you make a new will, you physically destroy the old one. You don't want someone finding the old one and probating it. Some folks change their wills every year, and as lawyers, we know to burn the old ones. The judge was a firm believer in destroying revoked wills because he spent 30 years refereeing will contests.
The fact that their close friend knew something about their dead father and that he was unwilling to share it chilled the conversation. Ray decided to wait until he was alone with Harry Rex to grill him.
McGargle's waiting, he said to Forrest. Sounds like fun.
They rolled the handsome oak casket down the east wing of the courthouse on a funeral gurney draped with purple velvet. Mr. McGargle led while an assistant pushed. Behind the casket were Ray and Forrest, and behind them was a Boy Scout color guard with flags and pressed khaki uniforms. Because Reuben V. Attlee had fought for his country, his casket was covered with the stars and stripes. And because of this, a contingent of reservists from the local armory snapped to attention when retired Captain Attlee was stopped in the center of the courthouse rotunda. Harry Rex was waiting there, dressed in a fine black suit, standing in front of a long row of floral arrangements. Every other lawyer in the county was present, too, and at Harry Rex's suggestion, they were cordoned off in a special section close to the casket. All city and county officials, courthouse clerks, cops, and deputies were present, and as Harry Rex stepped forward to begin, the crowd pressed closer. Above on the second and third levels of the courthouse, another crowd leaned on the iron railings and gawked downward. Ray wore a brand new navy suit he had purchased just hours earlier at Pope's, the only men's clothier in town. At $310, it was the most expensive in the store, and slashed from that hefty price was a 10% discount that Mr. Pope insisted on giving. Forrest's new suit was dark gray. It cost $280 before the discount, and it had also been paid for by Ray. Forrest had not worn a suit in 20 years, and swore he would not wear one for the funeral. Only a tongue-lashing by Harry Rex got him to Pope's. The sons stood at one end of the casket, Harry Rex at the other, and near the center of it, Billy Boone, the ageless courthouse janitor, had carefully placed a portrait of Judge Attlee. It had been painted 10 years earlier by a local artist for free, and everyone knew the judge had not been particularly fond of it. He hung it in his chambers behind his courtroom, behind a door so no one could see it. After his defeat, the county fathers placed it in the main courtroom, high above the bench. Programs had been printed for the farewell to Judge Reuben Attlee. Ray studied his intently because he didn't wish to look around the gathering. All eyes were on him and Forrest. Reverend Palmer delivered a windy prayer. Ray had insisted that the ceremony be brief. There was a funeral tomorrow. The Boy Scout stepped forward with the flag and led the congregation in the Pledge of Allegiance. Then Sister Olita Schumpert from the Holy Ghost Church of God in Christ stepped forward and sang a mournful rendition of Shall We Gather at the River, a cappella, because she certainly didn't need any support. The words and melody brought tears to the eyes of many, including Forrest, who stayed close to his brother's shoulder with his chin low. Standing next to the casket, listening to her rich voice echo upward through the rotunda, Ray for the first time felt the burden of his father's death. He thought of all the things they could have done together now that they were men, all the things they had not done when he and Forrest were just boys. But he had lived his life and the judge had lived his, and this had suited them both. It wasn't fair now to relive the past just because the old man was dead. He kept telling himself this. It was only natural at death to wish he had done more, but the truth was that the judge had carried a grudge for years after Ray left Clanton. And sadly, he had become a recluse since leaving the bench. A moment of weakness, and Ray stiffened his back. He would not beat himself up because he had chosen a path that was not the one his father wanted. Harry Rex began what he promised would be a brief eulogy.
"Today we gather here to say goodbye to an old friend," he began. "We all knew this day was coming, and we all prayed it would never get here."
He hit the highlights of the judge's career, then told of his first appearance in front of the great man 30 years ago, when Harry Rex was fresh out of law school. He was handling an uncontested divorce, which he somehow managed to lose. Every lawyer had heard the story 100 times, but they still managed a good laugh at the appropriate time. Ray glanced at them, then began studying them as a group. How could one small town have so many lawyers? He knew about half of them. Many of the old ones he had known as a child and as a student were either dead or retired. Many of the younger ones he had never seen before. Of course, they all knew him. He was Judge Attlee's boy. Ray was slowly realizing that his speedy exit from Clanton after the funeral would only be temporary. He would be forced to return very soon, to make a brief court appearance with Harry Rex and begin probate, to prepare an inventory, and do a half-dozen other duties as executor of his father's estate. That would be easy and routine and take just a few days. But weeks and perhaps months were looming out there as he tried to solve the mystery of the money. Did one of those lawyers over there know something? The money had to originate from a judicial setting, didn't it? The judge had no life outside of the law. Looking at them, though, Ray could not imagine a source rich enough to generate the kind of money now hidden in the trunk of his little car. They were small-town ham-and-egg lawyers, all scrambling to pay their bills and out-hustle the guy next door. There was no real money over there. The Sullivan firm had 8 or 9 lawyers who represented the banks and insurance companies, and they earned just enough to hang out with the doctors at the country club. There wasn't a lawyer in the county with serious cash. Irv Chamberlain, over there with the thick eyeglasses and bad hairpiece, owned thousands of acres handed down through generations, but he couldn't sell it because there were no buyers. Plus, it was rumored he was spending time at the new casinos in Tunica. As Harry Rex droned on, Ray dwelt on the lawyers. Someone shared the secret. Someone knew about the money. Could it be a distinguished member of the Ford County Bar? Harry Rex's voice began to break, and it was time to quit. He thanked them all for coming and announced that the judge would lie in state in the courthouse until 10 p.m. He directed the procession to begin where Ray and Forrest were standing. The crowd moved obediently to the east wing and formed a line that snaked its way outside. For an hour, Ray was forced to smile and shake hands and graciously thank everyone for coming. He listened to dozens of brief stories about his father and the lives the great man had touched. He pretended to remember the names of all those who knew him. He hugged old ladies he had never met before. The procession moved slowly by Ray and Forrest, then to the casket where each person would stop and gaze forlornly at the judge's bad portrait, then to the west wing where registers were waiting. Harry Rex moved about, working the crowd like a politician. At some point during the ordeal, Forrest disappeared. He mumbled something to Harry Rex about going home, to Memphis, and something about being tired of death. Finally, Harry Rex whispered to Ray, "There's a line around the courthouse. You could be here all night." "Get me out of here," Ray whispered back. "You need to go to the restroom?" Harry Rex asked, just loud enough for those next in line to hear. "Yes," Ray said, already stepping away. They eased back, whispering importantly, and ducked into a narrow hallway. Seconds later, they emerged behind the courthouse. They drove away in Ray's car, of course, first circling the square and taking in the scene. The flag in front of the courthouse was at half-mast. A large crowd waited patiently to pay their respects to the judge. Chapter 10. 24 hours in Clanton, and Ray was desperate to leave. After the wake, he ate dinner with Harry Rex at Claude's, the black diner on the south side of the square, where the Monday special was barbecued chicken and baked beans so spicy they served iced tea by the half gallon. Harry Rex was reveling in the success of his grand send-off for the judge, and after dinner was anxious to return to the courthouse and monitor the rest of the wake. Forrest had evidently left town for the evening. Ray hoped he was in Memphis, at home with Ellie behaving himself, but he knew better. How many times could he crash before he died? Harry Rex said there was a 50-50 chance Forrest would make it to the funeral tomorrow. When Ray was alone, he drove away, out of Clanton, headed west to no place in particular. There were new casinos along the river 70 miles away, and with each trip back to Mississippi, he heard more talk and gossip about the state's newest industry, legalized gambling, had arrived in the state with the lowest per capita income in the country. An hour and a half from Clanton, he stopped for gas, and as he pumped it, he noticed a new motel across the highway. Everything was new in what had recently been cotton fields. New roads, new motels, fast food restaurants, gas stations, billboards, all spillover from the casinos a mile away. The motel had rooms on two levels with doors that opened to face the parking lot. It appeared to be a slow night. He paid $39.99 for a double on the ground level, around back where there were no other cars or trucks. He parked the Audi as close as possible to his room, and within seconds had the three garbage bags inside. The money covered one bed. He did not stop to admire it because he was convinced it was dirty, and it was probably marked in some way. Maybe it was counterfeit. Whatever it was not his to keep. All the bills were $100 notes, some brand new and never used, others passed around a little. None were worn badly, and none were dated before 1986 or after 1994. About half were banded together in $2,000 stacks, and Ray counted those first. $100,000 in $100 bills was about 15 inches high. He counted the money from one bed, then arranged it on the other in neat rows and sections. He was very deliberate. Time was of no concern. As he touched the money, he rubbed it between his forefingers and thumbs, and even smelled it to see if it was counterfeit. It certainly appeared to be real. 31 sections plus a few leftovers. $3,118,000 to be exact. Retrieved like buried treasure from the crumbling home of a man who had earned less than half that during his lifetime. It was impossible not to admire the fortune spread before him. How many times in his life would he gaze upon $3 million? How many others ever got the chance? Ray sat in a chair with his face in his hands, staring at the tidy rows of cash, dizzy with thoughts of where it came from and where it was headed. A slamming car door somewhere outside jolted him back. This would be an excellent place to get robbed. When you travel around with millions in cash, everybody becomes a potential thief. He rebagged it, stuffed it back into the trunk of his car, and drove to the nearest casino. His involvement with gambling was limited to a weekend junket to Atlantic City with two other law professors, both of whom had read a book on successful crap shooting and were convinced they could beat the house. They did not. Ray had rarely played cards. He found a home at the $5 blackjack table, and after two miserable days in a noisy dungeon, he cleared $60 and vowed not to return. His colleagues' losses were never nailed down, but he learned that those who gamble quite often lie about their success. For a Monday night, there was a respectable crowd at the Santa Fe Club, a hastily built box the size of a football field. A 10-floor tower attached to it housed the guests, mostly retirees from up north who had never dreamed of setting foot in Mississippi, but were now lured by unlimited slots and free gin while they gambled. In his pocket, he had five bills taken from five different sections of the loot he had counted in the motel room. He walked to an empty blackjack table where the dealer was half asleep and placed the first bill on the table. "Play it," he said. "Playing 100, the dealer said over her shoulder, where no one was there to hear it. She picked up the bill, rubbed it with little interest, then put it in play. "It must be real," he thought, and relaxed a little. "She sees them all day long." She shuffled one deck, dealt the cards, promptly hit 24, then took the bill from Judge Attlee's buried treasure and put down two black chips. Ray played them both, $200 a bet, nerves of steel. She dealt the cards quickly, and with 15 showing, she hit a 9. Ray now had four black chips. In less than a minute, he had won $300. Rattling the four black chips in his pocket, he strolled through the casino, first through the slots where the crowd was older and subdued, almost brain-dead as they sat on their stools, pulling the arm down again and again, staring sadly at the screens. At the craps table, the dice were hot and a rowdy bunch of rednecks were hollering instructions that made no sense to him. He watched for a moment, completely bewildered by the dice and the bets and the chips changing hands. At another empty blackjack table, he tossed down the second $100 bill, more like a seasoned gambler now. The dealer pulled it close to his face, held it up to the lights, rubbed it, and took it a few steps over to the pit boss, who was immediately distrustful of it. The pit boss produced a magnifying device that he stuck in his left eye and examined the bill like a surgeon. Just as Ray was about to break and bolt through the crowd, he heard one of them say, "It's good." He wasn't sure which one said it because he was looking wildly around the casino for armed guards. The dealer returned to the table and placed the suspicious money in front of Ray, who said, "Play it." Seconds later, the Queen of Hearts and the King of Spades were staring at Ray, and he had won his third hand in a row. Since the dealer was wide awake and his supervisor had done a close inspection, Ray decided to settle the matter once and for all. He pulled the other $300 bills from his pocket and laid them on the table. The dealer inspected each carefully, then shrugged and said, "You won't change?" "No, play them." "Playing 300 cash," the dealer said loudly, and the pit boss loomed over his shoulder. Ray stood on a 10 and a 6. The dealer hit on a 10 and a 4, and when he turned over the jack of diamonds, Ray won his fourth straight hand. The cash disappeared and was replaced with 6 black chips. Ray now had 10, $1,000, and he also had the knowledge that the other 30,000 bills stuffed into the back of his car were not counterfeit. He left one chip for the dealer and went to find a beer. The sports bar was elevated a few feet, so that if you wanted, you could have a drink and take in all the action on the floor. Or you could watch pro baseball, or NASCAR reruns, or bowling on any of the dozen screens. But you couldn't gamble on the games. It wasn't allowed yet. He was aware of the risks the casino posed. Now that the money was real, the next question was whether it was marked in some way. The suspicions of the second dealer and his supervisor would probably be enough to get the bills examined by the boys upstairs. They had Ray on video, he was certain, same as everybody else. Casino surveillance was extensive. He knew that from his two bright pals who'd planned to break the bank at the craps table. If the money set off alarms, they could easily find him, couldn't they? But where else could he get the money examined? Walk into First National in Clanton and hand the teller a few of the bills? "Mind taking a look at these, Miss Dempsey? See if they're real or not?" No teller in Clanton had ever seen counterfeit money, and by lunch the entire town would know that Judge Attlee's boy was sneaking around with a pocket full of suspicious money. He had thought of waiting until he was back in Virginia. He would go to his lawyer, who could find an expert to examine a sample of the money, all nice and confidential. But he couldn't wait that long. If the money was fake, he'd burn it. Otherwise, he wasn't sure what to do with it. He drank his beer slowly, giving them time to send down a couple of goons in dark suits who would walk up and say, "Got a minute?" They couldn't work that fast, and Ray knew it. If the money was marked, it would take days to link it to wherever it came from. Suppose he got caught with marked money. What was his crime? He had taken it from his deceased father's house, a place that had been willed to him and his brother. He was the executor of the estate, soon to be charged with the responsibility of protecting its assets. He had months to report it to both the probate court and the tax authorities. If the judge had somehow accumulated the money by illegal means, then sorry, he's dead now. Ray had done nothing wrong, at least for the moment. He took his winnings back to the first blackjack table and placed a $500 bet. The dealer got the attention of her supervisor, who ambled over with his knuckles to his mouth and one finger tapping an ear smugly, as if $500 on one hand of blackjack happened all the time at the Santa Fe Club. He was dealt an ace and a king, and the dealer slid over $750. "Would you like something to drink?" asked the pit boss, all smiles and bad teeth. "Beck's beer," Ray said, and a cocktail waitress appeared from nowhere. He bet $100 on the next hand and lost. Then quickly he slid 3 chips out for the next hand, which he won. He won 8 of the next 10 hands, alternating his bets from $100 to $500, as if he knew precisely what he was doing. The pit boss lingered behind the dealer. They had a potential card counter on their hands, a professional blackjack player, one to be watched and filmed. The other casinos would be notified. If they only knew. He lost consecutive bets of $200, then just for the hell of it, pushed 10 chips out for a bold and reckless wager of $1,000. He had another $3 million in the trunk. This was chicken feed. When two queens landed next to his chips, he kept a perfect poker face as if he'd been winning like this for years. "Would you like dinner, sir?" the pit boss asked. "No," Ray said. "Can we get anything for you?" "A room would be nice." "King or a suite?" A jerk would have said a suite, of course. But Ray caught himself. "Any room will be fine," he said. He had had no plans to stay there, but after 2 beers he thought it best not to drive. What if he got stopped by a rural deputy? And what would the deputy do if he searched the trunk? "No problem, sir," said the pit boss. "I'll get you checked in." For the next hour he broke even. The cocktail waitress stopped by every 5 minutes pushing beverages, trying to loosen him up, but Ray nursed the first beer. During a shuffle, he counted 39 black chips. At midnight, he began yawning, and he remembered how little he had slept the night before. The room key was in his pocket. The table had a $1,000 limit per hand. Otherwise, he would have played it all at one time and gone down in a blaze of glory. He placed 10 black chips in the circle, and with an audience, hit blackjack. Another 10 chips, and the dealer blew it with 22. He gathered his chips, left 4 for the dealer, and went to the cashier. He'd been in the casino for 3 hours. From his 5th-floor room, he could see the parking lot, and because his sports car was within view, he felt compelled to watch it. As tired as he was, he could not fall asleep. He pulled a chair to the window and tried to doze, but couldn't stop thinking. Had the judge discovered the casinos? Could gambling be the source of his fortune, a lucrative little vice that he'd kept to himself? The more Ray told himself that the idea was too far-fetched, the more convinced he became that he had found the source of the money. To his knowledge, the judge had never played the stock market, and if he had, if he'd been another Warren Buffett, why would he take his profits in cash and hide it under the bookshelves? Plus, the paperwork would be thick. If he'd lived the double life of a judge on the take, there wasn't $3 million to steal on the court dockets in rural Mississippi, and taking bribes would involve too many other people. It had to be gambling. It was a cash business. Ray had just won $6,000 in one night. Sure, it was blind luck, but wasn't all gaming? Perhaps the old man had a knack for cards or dice. Maybe he hit one of the big jackpots in the slot machines. He lived alone and answered to no one. He could have pulled it off. But $3 million over 7 years? Didn't the casinos require paperwork for substantial winnings? Tax forms and such? And why hide it? Why not give it away like the rest of his money? Shortly after 3, Ray gave it up and left his complimentary room. He slept in his car until sunrise. Chapter 11. The front door was slightly cracked, and at 8 o'clock in the morning with no one living there, it was indeed an ominous sign. Ray stared at it for a long minute, not certain if he wanted to step inside, but knowing he had no choice. He shoved it wider, clenched his fists as if the thief just still might be in there, and took a very deep breath. It swung open, creaking every inch of the way, and when the light fell upon the stacks of boxes in the foyer, Ray saw muddy footprints on the floor. The assailant had entered from the rear lawn, where there was mud, and for some reason had chosen to leave through the front door. Ray slowly removed the pistol from his pocket. The 27 green Blake & Son boxes were scattered around the judge's study. The sofa was overturned. The doors to the cabinet below the bookshelves were open. The roll top appeared to be unmolested, but the papers from the desk were scattered on the floor. The intruder had removed the boxes, opened them, and finding them empty, had evidently stomped them and thrown them in a fit of rage. As still as things were, Ray felt the violence, and it made him weak. The money could get him killed. When he was able to move, he fixed the sofa and picked up the papers. He was gathering boxes when he heard something on the front porch. He peeked through the window and saw an old woman tapping on the front door. Claudia Gates had known the judge like no one else. She had been his court reporter, secretary, driver, and many other things, according to gossip that had been around since Ray was a small boy. For almost 30 years, she and the judge had traveled the 6 counties of the 25th District together, often leaving Clanton at 7 in the morning and returning long after dark. When they were not in court, they shared the judge's office in the courthouse, where she typed the transcripts while he did his paperwork. A lawyer named Turley had once caught them in a compromising position during lunch at the office, and he made the awful mistake of telling others about it. He lost every case in Chancery Court for a year and couldn't buy a client. It took 4 years for Judge Attlee to get him disbarred.
"Hello, Ray," she said through the screen. "May I come in?"
"Sure," he said, and opened the door wider. Ray and Claudia had never liked each other. He had always felt that she was getting the attention and affection that he and Forrest were not, and she viewed him as a threat as well. When it came to Judge Attlee, she viewed everyone as a threat. She had few friends and even fewer admirers. She was rude and callous because she spent her life listening to trials, and she was arrogant because she whispered to the great man.
"I'm very sorry," she said.
"So am I." As they walked by the study, Ray pulled the door closed and said, "Don't go in there." Claudia did not notice the intruder's footprints.
"Be nice to me, Ray," she said.
"Why?" They went to the kitchen where he put up some coffee, and they sat across from each other.
"Can I smoke?" she asked.
"I don't care," he said. "Smoke till you choke, old gal." His father's black suits had always carried the acrid smell of her cigarettes. He had allowed her to smoke in the car, in chambers, in his office, probably in bed, everywhere but the courtroom. The raspy breath, the gravelly voice, the countless wrinkles clustered around the eyes. Ah, the joys of tobacco. She had been crying, which was not an insignificant event in her life. When he was clerking for his father one summer, Ray had had the misfortune of sitting through a gut-wrenching child abuse case. The testimony had been so sad and pitiful that everyone, including the judge and all the lawyers, were moved to tears. The only dry eyes in the courtroom belonged to old stone-faced Claudia.
"I can't believe he's dead," she said, then blew a puff of smoke toward the ceiling.
"He's been dying for 5 years, Claudia. This is no surprise."
"It's still sad."
"It's very sad. But he was suffering at the end. Death was a blessing."
"He wouldn't let me come see him."
"We're not rehashing history, okay?" The history, depending on which version you believed, had kept Clanton buzzing for almost 2 decades. A few years after Ray's mother died, Claudia divorced her husband for reasons that were never clear. One side of town believed the judge had promised to marry her after her divorce. The other side of town believed the judge, forever an Attlee, never intended to marry such a commoner as Claudia, and that she got a divorce because her husband caught her fooling around with yet another man. Years passed with the two enjoying the benefits of married life, except for the paperwork and actual cohabitation. She continued to press the judge to get married. He continued to postpone things. Evidently, he was getting what he wanted. Finally, she put forth an ultimatum, which proved to be a bad strategy. Ultimatums did not impress Reuben Attlee. The year before he got booted from office, Claudia married a man 9 years younger. The judge promptly fired her, and the coffee shops and knitting clubs talked of nothing else. After a few rocky years, her younger man died. She was lonely, so was the judge. But she had betrayed him by remarrying, and he never forgave her.
"Where's Forrest?" she asked.
"He should be here soon."
"How is he?"
"He's Forrest."
"Do you want me to leave?"
"It's up to you."
"I'd rather talk to you, Ray. I need to talk to someone."
"Don't you have friends?"
"No. Reuben was my only friend."
He cringed when she called him Reuben. She stuck the cigarette between her gluey red lips, a pale red for mourning, not the bright red she was once known for. She was at least 70, but wearing it well. Still straight and slim, and wearing a tight dress that no other 70-year-old woman in Ford County would attempt. She had diamonds in her ears and one on her finger, though he couldn't tell if they were real. She was also wearing a pretty gold pendant and two gold bracelets. She was an aging tart, but still an active volcano. He would ask Harry Rex whom she was seeing these days. He poured more coffee and said, "What would you like to talk about?"
"Reuben,
my father is dead. I don't like history."
"Can't we be friends?"
"No. We've always despised each other. We're not going to kiss and hug now over the casket. Why would we do that?"
"I'm an old woman, Ray."
"And I live in Virginia. We'll get through the funeral today, then we'll never see each other again. How's that?" She lit another one and cried some more. Ray was thinking about the mess in the study and what he would say to Forrest if he barged in now and saw the footprints and scattered boxes. And if Forrest saw Claudia sitting at the table, he might go for her neck. Though they had no proof, Ray and Forrest had long suspected that the judge had paid her more than the going rate for court reporters. Something extra in exchange for the extra she was providing. It was not difficult holding a grudge.
"I want something to remember, that's all," she said.
"You want to remember me?"
"You are your father, Ray. I'm clinging here."
"Are you looking for money?"
"No."
"Are you broke?"
"I'm not set for life, no."
"There's nothing here for you."
"Do you have his will?"
"Yes, and your name is not mentioned." She cried again, and Ray began a slow burn. She got the money 20 years ago when he was waiting tables and living on peanut butter and trying to survive another month of law school without getting evicted from his cheap apartment. She always had a new Cadillac when he and Forrest were driving Rex. They were expected to live like impoverished gentry while she had the wardrobe and the jewelry.
"He always promised to take care of me," she said.
"He broke it off years ago, Claudia. Give it up."
"I can't. I loved him too much."
"It was sex and money, not love. I'd rather not talk about it."
"What's in the estate?"
"Nothing. He gave it all away."
"He what?"
"You heard me. You know how he loved to write checks. It got worse after you left the picture."
"What about his retirement?"
She wasn't crying now. This was business. Her green eyes were dry and glowing. "He cashed in the year after he left office. It was a terrible financial blunder, but he did it without my knowledge. He was mad and half crazy. He took the money, lived on some of it, and gave the rest to the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Lions Club, Sons of the Confederacy, committed to preserve historic battlefields, you name it." If his father had been a crooked judge, something Ray was not willing to believe, then Claudia would know about the money. It was obvious she did not. Ray never suspected she knew, because if she had, then the money would not have remained hidden in the study. Let her have a rip at $3 million and everybody in the county would know about it. If she had a dollar, you were going to see it. As pitiful as she looked across the table, Ray suspected she had very few dollars. "I thought your second husband had some money," he said, with a little too much cruelty.
"So did I,"
she said and managed a smile. Ray chuckled a bit. Then they both laughed, and the ice thawed dramatically. She had always been known for her bluntness. "Never found it, huh?"
"Not a dime. He was this nice-looking guy, 9 years younger, you know."
"I remember it well. A regular scandal."
"He was 51 years old, a smooth talker, had a line about making money and all. We drilled like crazy for 4 years, and I came up with nothing."
Ray laughed louder. He could not at that moment ever remember having a talk about sex and money with a 70-year-old woman. He got the impression she had plenty of stories. Claudia's greatest hits. "You're looking good, Claudia. You have time for another one."
"I'm tired, Ray. Old and tired. I'd have to train him and all. It's not worth it."
"What happened to number two?"
"He croaked with a heart attack, and I didn't even find $1,000, she said.
"The judge left six."
"Is that all?"
she asked in disbelief. "No stocks, no bonds, nothing but an old house and $6,000 in the bank." She lowered her eyes, shook her head, and believed everything Ray was saying. She had no clue about the cash.
What will you do with the house?
Forrest wants to burn it and collect the insurance.
Not a bad idea.
We'll sell it. There was noise on the porch, then a knock. Reverend Palmer was there to discuss the funeral service, which would begin in 2 hours. Claudia hugged Ray as they walked to her car. She hugged him again and said goodbye.
I'm sorry I wasn't nicer to you,
she whispered as he opened her car door. Goodbye, Claudia. I'll see you at the church.
He never forgave me, Ray.
I forgive you.
Did you really?
Yes, you're forgiven. We're friends now.
Thank you so much.
She hugged him a third time and started crying. He helped her into the car, always a Cadillac. Just before she turned the ignition, she said,
Did he ever forgive you, Ray?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
But it's not important now. Let's get him buried.
He could be a mean old sumbitch, couldn't he?
She said, smiling through the tears. Ray had to laugh. His dead father's 70-year-old former lover had just called the great man a son of a bitch. Yes, he agreed. He certainly could be. Chapter 12. They rolled Judge Attlee down the center aisle in his fine oak casket and parked him at the altar in front of the pulpit where Reverend Palmer was waiting in a black robe. The casket was left unopened, much to the disappointment of the mourners, most of whom still clung to the ancient Southern ritual of viewing the deceased one last time in a strange effort to maximize the grief. Hell no, Ray had said politely to Mr. McGargle when asked about opening things up. When the pieces were in place, Palmer slowly stretched out his arms, then lowered them, and the crowd sat. In the front pew to his right was the family, the two sons. Ray wore his new suit and looked tired. Forrest wore jeans and a black suede jacket and looked remarkably sober. Behind them were Harry Rex and the other pallbearers, and behind them was a sad collection of ancient judges, not far from the casket themselves. In the front pew to his left were all sorts of dignitaries, politicians, an ex-governor, a couple of Mississippi Supreme Court justices. Clanton had never seen such power assembled at one time. The sanctuary was packed, with folks standing along the walls under the stained glass windows. The balcony above was full. One floor below, the auditorium had been wired for audio, and more friends and admirers were down there. Ray was impressed by the crowd. Forrest was already looking at his watch. He had arrived 15 minutes earlier and got cursed by Harry Rex, not Ray. His new suit was dirty, he had said, and besides, Ellie had bought him the black suede jacket years ago, and she thought it would do just fine for the occasion. She, at 300 pounds, would not leave the house, and for that Ray and Harry Rex were grateful. Somehow she'd kept him sober, but a crash was in the air. For 1,000 reasons, Ray just wanted to get back to Virginia. The Reverend prayed a short, eloquent message of thanks for the life of a great man. Then he introduced a youth choir that had won national honors at a music competition in New York. Judge Attlee had given them $3,000 for the trip, according to Palmer. They sang 2 songs Ray had never heard before, but they sang them beautifully. The first eulogy, and there would be only 2 short ones per Ray's instructions, was delivered by an old man who barely made it to the pulpit, but once there startled the crowd with a rich and powerful voice. He'd been in law school with the judge 100 years ago. He told 2 humorless stories, and the potent voice began to fade. The Reverend read some scripture and delivered words of comfort for the loss of a loved one, even an old one who had lived a full life. The second eulogy was given by a young black man named Nikita Poole, something of a legend in Clanton. Poole came from a rough family south of town, and had it not been for a chemistry teacher at the high school, he would have dropped out in the 9th grade and become another statistic. The judge met him during an ugly family matter in court, and he took an interest in the kid. Poole had an amazing capacity for science and math. He finished first in his class, applied to the best colleges, and was accepted everywhere. The judge wrote powerful letters of recommendation and pulled every string he could grab. Nikita picked Yale, and its financial package covered everything but spending money. For 4 years, Judge Attlee wrote him every week, and in each letter, there was a check for $25.
"I wasn't the only one getting the letters or the checks," he said to a silent crowd. "There were many of us."
Nikita was now a doctor and headed for Africa for 2 years of volunteer work.
"I'm going to miss those letters," he said,
and every lady in the church was in tears. The coroner, Thurber Foreman, was next. He had been a fixture at funerals in Ford County for many years, and the judge specifically wanted him to play his mandolin and sing "Just a Closer Walk with Thee." He sang it beautifully, and somehow managed to do so while weeping. Forrest finally began wiping his eyes. Ray just stared at the casket, wondering where the cash came from. What had the old man done? What exactly did he think would happen to the money after he died? When the Reverend finished a very brief message, the pallbearers rolled Judge Attlee out of the sanctuary. Mr. McGargle escorted Ray and Forrest down the aisle and down the front steps to a limo waiting behind the hearse. The crowd spilled out and went to their cars for the ride to the cemetery. Like most small towns, Clanton loved a funeral procession. All traffic stopped. Those not driving in the procession were on the sidewalks, standing sadly and gazing at the hearse and the endless parade of cars behind it. Every part-time deputy was in uniform and blocking something, a street, an alley, parking spaces. The hearse led them around the courthouse, where the flag was at half-mast, and the county employees lined the front sidewalk and lowered their heads. The merchants around the square came out to bid farewell to Judge Attlee. He was laid to rest in the Attlee plot, next to his long-forgotten wife, and among the ancestors he so revered. He would be the last Attlee returned to the dust of Ford County, though no one knew it. And certainly no one cared. Ray would be cremated and his ashes scattered over the Blue Ridge Mountains. Forrest admitted he was closer to death than his older brother, but he had not nailed down his final details. The only thing for certain was that he would not be buried in Clanton. Ray was lobbying for cremation. Ellie liked the idea of a mausoleum. Forrest preferred not to dwell on the subject. The mourners crowded under and around a crimson McGargle funeral home tent, which was much too small. It covered the grave and four rows of folding chairs. 1,000 were needed. Ray and Forrest sat with their knees almost touching the casket and listened as Reverend Palmer wrapped it all up. Sitting in a folding chair at the edge of his father's open grave, Ray found it odd the things he thought about. He wanted to go home. He missed his classroom and his students. He missed flying and the views of the Shenandoah Valley from 5,000 feet. He was tired and irritable and did not want to spend the next 2 hours lingering in the cemetery making small talk with people who remembered when he was born. The wife of a Pentecostal preacher had the final words. She sang Amazing Grace, and for 5 minutes time stood still. In a beautiful soprano, her voice echoed through the gentle hills of the cemetery, comforting the dead, giving hope to the living. Even the birds stopped flying. An army boy with a trumpet played taps, and everybody had a good cry. They folded the flag and handed it to Forrest, who was sobbing and sweating under the damned suede jacket. As the final notes faded into the woods, Harry Rex started bawling behind them. Ray leaned forward and touched the casket. He said a silent farewell, then rested with his elbows on his knees, his face in his hands. The burial broke up quickly. It was time for lunch. Ray figured that if he just sat there and stared at the casket, then folks would leave him alone. Forrest flung a heavy arm across his shoulders, and together they looked as though they might stay until dark. Harry Rex regained his composure and assumed the role of family spokesman. Standing outside the tent, he thanked the dignitaries for coming, complimented Palmer on a fine service, praised the preacher's wife for such a beautiful rendition, told Claudia that she could not sit with the boys, that she needed to move along, and on and on. The gravediggers waited under a nearby tree, shovels in hand. When everybody was gone, including Mr. McGargle and his crew, Harry Rex fell into the chair on the other side of Forrest, and for a long time the three of them sat there, staring and not wanting to leave. The only sound was that of a backhoe somewhere in the distance, waiting. But Forrest and Ray didn't care. How often do you bury your father? And how important is time to a gravedigger?
What a great funeral,
Harry Rex finally said. He was an expert on such matters.
He would have been proud, said Forrest.
He loved a good funeral, Ray added. Hated weddings, though.
I love weddings, said Harry Rex. Four or five? Asked Forrest. Four and counting.
A man in a city work uniform approached and quietly asked,
Would you like for us to lower it now?
Neither Ray nor Forrest knew how to respond. Harry Rex had no doubt. Yes, please, he said. The man turned a crank under the grave apron. Very slowly the casket began sinking. They watched it until it came to rest deep in the red soil. The man removed the belts, the apron, and the crank, and disappeared.
I guess it's over, Forrest said.
Lunch was tamales and sodas at a drive-in on the edge of town, away from the crowded places where someone would undoubtedly interrupt them with a few kind words about the judge. They sat on a wooden picnic table under a large umbrella and watched the cars go by.
When are you heading back? Harry Rex asked.
First thing in the morning, Ray answered.
We have some work to do.
I know. Let's do it this afternoon.
What kind of work? Forrest asked. Probate stuff, Harry Rex said. We'll open the estate in a couple of weeks, whenever Ray can get back. We need to go through the judge's papers now and see how much work there is. Sounds like a job for the executor.
You can help.
Ray was eating and thinking about his car, which was parked on a busy street near the Presbyterian Church. Surely it was safe there.
I went to a casino last night, he announced with his mouth full.
Which one? Asked Harry Rex.
Santa Fe something or other. First one I came to.
You been there?
I've been to all of them, he said, as if he'd never go back.
With the exception of illegal narcotics, Harry Rex had explored every vice.
Me too,
said Forrest, a man with no exceptions.
How'd you do? Forrest asked.
I won a couple of thousand at blackjack. They comped me a room.
I paid for that damn room, Harry Rex said. Probably the whole floor. I love their free drinks, said Forrest. $20 a pop.
Ray swallowed hard and decided to set the bait. I found some matches from the Santa Fe on the old man's desk.
Was he sneaking over there?
Sure, said Harry Rex.
He and I used to go once a month. He loved the dice.
The old man? Forrest asked. Gambling?
Yep. So there's the rest of my inheritance. What he didn't give away, he gambled away. No, he was actually a pretty good player.
Ray pretended to be as shocked as Forrest, but he was relieved to pick up his first clue, slight as it was. It seemed almost impossible that the judge could have amassed such a fortune shooting craps once a week. He and Harry Rex would pursue it later. Chapter 13. As he approached the end, the judge had been diligent in organizing his affairs. The important records were in his study and easily found. They went through his mahogany desk first. One drawer had 10 years' worth of bank statements, all arranged nearly in chronological order. His tax returns were in another. There were thick ledger books filled with entries of the donations he had made to everybody who had asked. The largest drawer was filled with letter-sized manila files, dozens of them. Files on property taxes, medical records, old deeds and titles, bills to pay, judicial conferences, letters from his doctors, his retirement fund. Ray flipped through the row of files without opening them, except for the bills to pay. There was one, $13.80 to Wayne's lawnmower repair, dated a week earlier.
It's always weird going through the papers of someone who just died, Harry Rex said. I feel dirty. Like a peeping Tom.
More like a detective looking for clues, Ray said. He was on one side of the desk, Harry Rex the other, their ties off and sleeves rolled up, with piles of evidence between them. Forrest was his usual helpful self. He had drained half a six-pack for dessert after lunch, and was now snoring it off in the swing on the front porch. But he was there instead of lost in one of his patented binges. He had disappeared so many times over the years. If he'd blown off his father's funeral, no one in Clanton would have been surprised. Just another black mark against that crazy Attlee boy. Another story to tell. In the last drawer they found personal odds and ends. Pens, pipes, pictures of the judge with his cronies at bar conventions, a few photos of Ray and Forrest from years ago, his marriage license, and their mother's death certificate. In an old, unopened envelope, there was her obituary clipped from the Clanton Chronicle dated October 12, 1969, complete with a photograph. Ray read it and handed it to Harry Rex. "Do you remember her?" Ray asked. "Yes, I went to her funeral," he said, looking at it. "She was a pretty lady who didn't have many friends." "Why not?" "She was from the Delta, and most of those folks have a good dose of blue blood. That's what the judge wanted in a wife, but it didn't work too well around here. She thought she was marrying money. Judges didn't make squat back then, so she had to work hard at being better than everybody else."
"You didn't like her?"
"Not particularly. She thought I was unpolished."
"Imagine that."
"I loved your father, Ray, but there weren't too many tears at her funeral."
"Let's get through one funeral at a time."
"Sorry.
What was in the will you prepared for him, the last one?"
Harry Rex laid the obituary on the desk and sat back in his chair. He glanced at the window behind Ray, then spoke softly. "The judge wanted to set up a trust so that when this place was sold, the money would go there. I'd be the trustee, and as such, I'd have the pleasure of doling out the money to you and him." He nodded toward the porch. "But his first $100,000 would be paid back to the estate. That's how much the judge figured Forrest owed him."
"What a disaster."
"I tried to talk him out of it."
"Thank God he burned it."
"Yes, indeed. He knew it was a bad idea, but he was trying to protect Forrest from himself."
"We've been trying for 20 years.
"He thought of everything. He was going to leave it all to you, cut him out completely, but he knew that would only cause friction. Then he got mad because neither of you would ever live here, so he asked me to do a will that gave the house to the church. He never signed it. Then Palmer pissed him off over the death penalty, and he ditched that idea. Said he would have it sold after his death and give the money to charity."
He stretched his arms upward until his spine popped.
Harry Rex had had 2 back surgeries and was seldom comfortable. He continued, "I'm guessing the reason he called you and Forrest home was so the 3 of you could decide what to do with the estate."
"Then why did he do a last-minute will?"
"We'll never know, will we? Maybe he got tired of the pain. I suspect he'd grown fond of the morphine like most folks at the end. Maybe he knew he was about to die."
Ray looked into the eyes of General Nathan Bedford Forrest, who had been gazing sternly on the judge's study from the same perch for almost